This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Professor John Gerasi, author of Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates.
If you want to know what Sartre thought about the Spanish Civil War, the Palestinian struggle, Che Guevara, and other amazing issues, listen to this remarkable interview.
Stay with us.
Michael, White House counsel Greg Craig, who set up a large office and came in with much promise, has now been forced out and is going to be leaving office at the end of the month. What did you make of all of that?
You know, Greg Craig is a longtime Washington insider, argued the impeachment case in favor of President Clinton, and is well known within the Beltway. He came into the Obama administration with great promise, a liberal, you know, certainly not a leftist by any means, but a liberal, and actually apparently had to resign or was forced to resign or decided to resign, falling on the sword of Guantanamo is the best way to put it. He came in with the idea of closing Guantanamo within the year. Apparently he was opposed to military commissions and preventive detention, and he also wanted released torture documents and torture photos. That didn't sit well with the national security establishment in Washington. He lost a couple of the major battles. As our listeners know, we are going to have a preventive detention scheme carried on from the Bush administration. We are going to have military trials. And President Obama reversed Craig's decision that had been made with others to release the photos of torture, and at the last minute said they couldn't be released. So Craig took a lot of hits and I guess decided that he couldn't beat the national security establishment in this country, couldn't get beyond that, and finally just quit. So it does seem, I wouldn't say another disappointment in terms of Obama, because I think a lot of us didn't expect much more, but it's certainly another indication that we are not going to see real change in Washington or in this country or in this world under the Obama administration.
Exactly, Michael. And I think that's a good lead into the other update we wanted to discuss, and that's Obama's announcement last week of the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. I suppose we should have been prepared for it. There were certainly a lot of hints. Policy-wise, he'd been moving steadily to the right, not only with the civil liberties issues that you just mentioned, but with this awful health care scheme that seems to just encrust health care for profit for the indefinite future. But last night, I think, and I wonder whether you agree with me, it was a real turning point when he announced sending 35,000 more troops to Afghanistan. I think, Michael, that was a real turning point in this administration.
Well, you know, as you said, we've been warned for a while. We knew it was coming. There's been leaks over the last 3 months while he's supposedly twisted in the wind on what to do. He had a request of 40,000 troops from McChrystal, the chief military guy in Afghanistan. He, in the end, gave 30,000 and claims he's going to get 10,000 more. Might get 10,000 more from the NATO countries, but it's an utter disaster. And there's nothing else to say. You know, since you and I have been kids, Michael, this country has been in permanent war. That's what we do. That's what we apparently, and I'm not saying we do it best, but we certainly do it. And we kill people. It's a really, really sad chapter. And there's no excuse for it. The excuse that somehow Al-Qaeda will go back into Afghanistan is just made up. I mean, there's no Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So we're not even being told the truth. What is this about? Yeah, maybe it's perhaps it's somehow about Pakistan in some way, but that's not really clear. And it was sad to read the New York Times editorial the day after the speech when it, of course, said, well, look, the Karzai government has some illegitimacy about it. The Pakistan government isn't cooperating. We hope Obama tells them more directly they have to do better. But in the end, the New York Times, as it has endorsed, as I can tell, every single war that has been going on since I've been born, endorsed the military buildup in Afghanistan. So it's really another sad day for America, and it's the nature of who our country is.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think one explanation for why they're in Afghanistan is just military inertia. It's the power of the military industrial complex. But I think there's also another explanation, and that was the one that we shared with Con Hanlahan when we interviewed him. And he said it's really pipe Lannistan. And he's not an economic determinist, and it's not always follow the dollar. But in this instance, he was saying that Afghanistan is right in the center of a geostrategic part of the globe that the United States must control. It must control it for one thing, so they can put an oil or natural gas pipeline through Afghanistan from the oil gas-rich Caspian. They tried to do that 8 years ago with the Taliban, and the deal fell through. Maybe they'll be able to do it again if they militarily occupy Afghanistan. The other reason, he said, and I agree with him, is that the oil and gas resources that lie in that part of the world, the United States doesn't necessarily need, but it needs to control them. It needs to control them vis-a-vis China, its upcoming rival, or India, its upcoming rival, or Russia, its upcoming rival. And that's why Obama is looking at the long-range interests of the ruling elites in this country and saying, we have to be in Afghanistan now, or we're going to be in trouble years and years from now.
Lastly, in our updates today, we have to bring you news of an outrageous act and a demonstration of how far, really, parts of this country has gone down the trail of denying people First Amendment rights to speak and what Guantanamo still represents to people. A lawyer, Mark Falkoff, who over time has represented some 17 Guantanamo detainees and who is the editor of the book Poems from Guantanamo, The Detainees Speak, an important book that we have covered previously on this show, was scheduled to speak at McHenry County College in Illinois. But all of a sudden, a night or two before the lecture, they pulled a plug on Mark Falkoff, saying that they were not ready for the crowds and wanted more time to prepare. Of course, it was a political decision. There were a lot of protests against Mark for giving the talk. The interim president said, "We're not canceling, we're just postponing it for a later date. We will make sure we have done the necessary preparations." She claimed she couldn't bring sufficient police presence to the campus. The police denied that. In fact, they said, "The story I've heard from some folks is that we weren't going to be able to provide officers at the lecture." It's blatantly untrue, the police department said. So what we have here is political censorship at its highest. Mark Falkoff responded to the cancellation by saying, "This is the first time an event has ever been canceled. This is mob rule. It's remarkable. A university is a sanctuary for free speech and robust debate. And I would hope the college would come out and say how intolerable what happened is." If people feel strongly about what happened to Mark Falkoff and the cancellation by McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois, you can go to our website and find the number and email and protest directly to the college and the president. It's another outrage as we continue on the Guantanamo saga.
We're going to speak today with John Jurassic about his new book, Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates. Sartre was one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century. He was best friends with Jurassic's parents. Jurassic's father was the last commanding general in Spain during the Spanish Civil War. When Jurassic, who moved from France to the United States, went back to France, he began tape recording these conversations with Sartre. They range from anti-colonial struggles that Sartre took part in Algeria, Vietnam. They talk about his friendship with his father, with his meeting Fidel, what it was like to know Che Guevara. It's an extraordinarily important and interesting book, Talking with Sartre. And we have today John Jurassic, the author of the book, talking with Michael Ratner, Heidi Boghossian, and myself, Michael Smith. This is one of the most exciting interviews we've ever done. We're joined today by John Jurassic, who now teaches political science at Queens College. He's the author of 11 books, including the memorable Great Fear in Latin America. He used to be a reporter at Time Magazine and Newsweek. John Jurassic, you've just come out with the book, Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates. It's a great book. We all loved it. It's like having Sartre in the room with us. But we want to go to the basic question. How did you know Sartre? Who was he? Tell us about yourself and tell us how you got into a situation where you sat down and had all these conversations and debates with him.
Well, Sartre and my parents were very close. My father's an artist and said ridiculous things like, "I don't care if my son starves. I don't care if my wife starves. First, I paint." And this appealed to Sartre, who said, in effect, the same thing as a littérateur, you know, man of letters, right? And then my father goes off to fight in Spain and has never fought anywhere before. He ends up being a general, the last defender of Barcelona, and it sort of flips.
Your father was Spanish origin.
Yes, right. Sephardic Jew. He was actually born in Constantinople, right. Istanbul, right? And so Sartre and my father became Sartre specifically became fascinated with my father. There was a kind of relationship that he continued all the time through the Second World War. And then my father, you know, ended up going to the United States with us and my family, and he got into OSS and was...
OSS being the predecessor of the CIA, right. Which is very interesting.
Right.
But keep going.
With all the other lefties, Marcuse and so on, they're all in...
Oh, I didn't know Marcuse was in the OSS.
Yeah.
But this is during the war.
Right, and all the Spanish Republicans.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the guy who did the great escape in real life, a guy called Felton, who was a guerrilla in Spain, that managed to get out. Donovan, who's head of OSS, sent him into Africa to prepare for the landing, and then sent him to the partisans. Right? Referred to him in the documents that I finally saw as the Expendables. Right.
Anyway, we're getting off the track here. Your father fought with the OSS against the fascists. He refused to join the CIA and got into a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah.
But that's another story. But keep talking about how you knew Sartre.
So they were stuck. They could never travel because they never had any papers, right?
They were living here.
Yeah. They finally got the papers thanks to Calder, who is on the cover of the book. That
right. Calder has a beautiful wire sculpture of Sartre that's the front cover of the paperback. It's absolutely wonderful.
And Calder gave me that thing called the drawing of that, and that's how it ended up on the cover. But Calder had sold a mobile to
Fortas.
Abe Fortas. And Calder asked Abe Fortas, to check out on my father's immigration status. Immigration told him it's at CIA because CIA was trying to blackmail my father to join CIA.
And they were holding up his immigration status.
So they couldn't travel. Eventually, Bobby Kennedy asked Johnson to make it by decree, right? And they became citizens by decree. But during that time, they couldn't travel. So I decided I would represent my family and go to see all his old buddies. And I get to France, of course, I look up Simone de Beauvoir. I didn't remember her, what she looked like, or didn't remember Sartre. You know, I hadn't seen him since I was 6 years old, right? But they invited me to come and meet the family, which is basically composed of all the students of Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, sort of. And these students were very loyal and fighters and so on. They were usually in the resistance movement. Some ended up right-wing, like Lanzmann, although he did that fantastic movie, Shoah, but he really is still alive. He's now right-wing. But the others were loyal, and Simone de Beauvoir thought that I should meet them all, so I came there and we to a meeting at the Falstaff, which is a cafe off the Montparnasse. I got introduced to everyone. This is the small Tito, the petit Tito, you know, and all that.
Yeah, the book describes it sort of as like a homecoming for this six-year-old boy who they hadn't seen for 20 years and the son of one of their closest friend.
Right.
You know, your father and your mother.
And then Sartre all of a sudden says, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm preparing a dissertation on you. I said, on what? And I said, well, first I tried the aesthetics. They wouldn't accept that, this and so on. Finally, I'm doing on the phenomenology of emotion. But I'm having problems because I can't find any solution to your problem. He says, what's my problem? And I said, well, uniting the idea of free choice that you have in existentialism, because you begin with the I, to the Marxist situation, which is a class derivative, to which you want to ally it. I don't see how you're going to unite existentialism and Marxism. So he said, well, that's my big problem. And then apparently, I don't remember this, but apparently I went through a whole gamut of criticisms of his philosophy that I had based on that dichotomy. And when I finished, he said, this kid's brilliant. I mean, he's part of the family. And boom, I became part of the family.
We're speaking with John Gerasi. His new book, Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates that that Tito, as we call John, had with Sartre in the early 70s, 70 to 73, and we're excited to have you here.
Tito, Sartre was a hero of ours. When we were, we're 60s radicals, all of us, and we looked around in our country, and there are no intellectuals other than Chomsky. There were no intellectuals that were on our side against the war in Vietnam. And we looked over to France, and Sartre had come out against his country's suppression of the Algerians. He supported the Vietnamese against the French. When the United States tried to take over for the French and repress the Vietnamese, we all got active in the anti-war movement, and Sartre was right there at our side. And it's so amazing that this book, Talking with Sartre, it's like he's in the room with us, that the problems that we had then in building a movement and what kind of a movement we want to see and what's the place of the individual and what kind of party we want to have. What's our evaluation of Cuba? What did you think of Che? What did you think of Fidel? What would you be doing now with the war in Afghanistan and Iraq? It's all totally contemporary. And we're really grateful for you for putting together this book. It's a great book, Talking with Sartre. Here's my question for you. Let's pretend we had Sartre in the room, and Michael and Heidi and I and you, and he's here, and we're reading the New York Times. The Times reports Obama's speech at the funeral service for the 12 men that were tragically killed at Fort Hood. And Obama says this, and we read this quote to Sartre. "It may be hard to comprehend the twisted logic that led to this tragedy," the president said, "but this much we do know. No faith justifies these murderous and craven acts. No just and loving God looks upon them with favor. For what he has done, we know that the killer will be met with justice in this world and the next." What do you think Sartre would have said? He was known as the hated conscience of his century. What would he have said to a comment that like title, this from Obama?
By the way, hated conscience of his century was my biography that I brought out before. Sartre was always in favor or always supported counterterrorism, that is, those who fought the establishment's terrorism. For example, he was one of the first to support Fanon and the Algerian Revolution. And he wrote an introduction to a preface to Fanon's Wretched on the Earth, and in effect made Fanon famous in Europe, because nobody knew about Fanon before. And Sartre's anti-position has always been consistently correct. For example, he opposed Ridgway when Ridgway took over the NATO and helped lead the big demonstrations against NATO, which got de Gaulle, this was under the first term of de Gaulle, to finally tell the Americans, get your base out of France. We don't want any American bases here. And made that famous statement, which is, no country is free that has a foreign base on its territory, right? And Ridgway, and he said, if you don't get rid of Ridgway, don't put in a European, because NATO is Europe, not American, a European general in charge of NATO, we're going to pull out of NATO as well. So the Americans gave in on that point, and I think it was a Dutchman, that general Dutch. So he's always been that. He's always fought that way. During the Algerian War, the magazine that Sartre basically created, which is called Modern Times, right, Les Temps Modernes, supported the Algerians right from the beginning and actually ran articles written by Ben Bella and various other revolutionaries and supported sedition. That was a step further than any lefty in France, right? The Communist Party at that time was a pro-government. They were part of the government. It was a tripartite government, socialist, Gaullist, and communist, right? They were together. The Minister of Justice, by the way, was Mitterrand, who later became president, and he made that famous statement, Algeria will always be French, right? And so on. The Temps Modernes began to write against that and to support sedition. Now, to support sedition in writing is one thing, but they ended up actually supporting it in action. They were called the suitcase carriers, right? Because all of them committed themselves to put, first, it was medicine and ammunition into the suitcase and give it to the FLN, right, the Algerians, and then finally guns, and actually hide the revolutionaries who were in France trying to sabotage the
shipment. This was really the group around Sartre and Le Temps Modernes, the Modern Times, as
right,
you say.
Exactly, right. And finally, what happened is that the guy who was the day-by-day editor, editor-in-chief of the magazine, a guy called Francis Janson, ended up getting 120 other intellectuals together, and this got published the famous Declaration of 121. And 121 included not just Sartre and the existentialists, but it included the Catholic left, for example, Claude Mauriac and various other people like that, right? And it included some notable communist intellectuals. And that began the split in the Communist Party, which was eventually taken over by supporters of the Algerian Revolution. Also, in Algeria, the whole Communist Party there was in favor of the Algerian Revolution. And one of the most famous books at that time, which for some reason has ever been published in this country, called The Question, was...
It has been published.
It just was published.
We interviewed Henri Alleg a year ago in our show.
And I know Henri from
France. Oh, really?
Sure. Did you know him?
He's great.
For our listeners, Henri Alleg wrote a book called The Question when he was in an Algerian prison. They waterboarded him. We've covered him a couple of times on our show. When he comes back here, we'll have to put you guys together.
Absolutely.
He's a wonderful guy.
I have his email address, I'll share it with you.
He's running the newspaper, the daily paper in Algiers now.
He moved from Paris to
he
Algiers?
He went back to Algeria.
We just saw him a few years ago in New York. Anyway, that's very funny.
Continue on. So
Sartre was really
French committed. When they were trying to suppress the Algerians.
Janson and those who were caught actually carrying or charged, they were never really physically caught, but who declared that they were carriers of arms and munitions and so on like that, were put on trial. At the time, Sartre was in Brazil, so there was a little bit of friction because Janson was very unhappy that he didn't show up to testify. But he did send a letter, and that letter was read at the trial, in which he declared himself a total supporter of the sedition. And as soon as I get back, I will start carrying arms to the FLN.
Now, let me ask you a question based on Michael's quote. I understand the story about Sartre, and I'm interested in this. We're talking about the killing of the 13 people at Fort Hood and what Obama said. Right. So are we putting those two together?
Sartre always made that difference. Specifically, the difference reads like this. Never judge the powerless by the same criteria that you judge the powerful.
He always said, put it in context, right?
Right.
That's what I'm reading in your book now.
Right. And that means, in other words, that you support the Palestinians and you support and you praise the suicide bombers because you judge them by a different criteria than you judge the Israelis who have tanks, airplanes, and so on, et cetera. And he would have used that judgment if he were alive at Fort Hood. He said, this guy who either went berserk or simply suddenly got political decided to finally get off his safe seat and commit himself. And it doesn't matter whether they find him to have been crazy or because they find that he was ridiculed by his fellow soldiers for praying at 5 o'clock or when the sun goes down, etc. The fact is that he is a member of the dominated class. And he's rebelling against the dominating class. And he's perfectly justified in doing whatever he wants to do, even if it appears to us as contradictory or as self-defeating or whatever, right? The fact is that you have to judge him by the fact that he is a member of the oppressed classes and minorities in the world, right?
What was fascinating, when I was reading the section on both Cuba and the Red Army faction, of course, the German group. On the Red Army faction, you ask Sartre the question, how do you situate the Red Army faction in this question of using violence as an against oppression? And Sartre answers, you mean the Bader-Meinhof group? In context, they were totally justified. And then he goes on and you give his explanation in the book. So that's, again, similar to what you're really speaking of. Now, the issue of Cuba came up in here, and Sartre says to you, I am so totally opposed to capital punishment that it creates a problem. And here's what he's talking about. After the revolution, Fidel, there were trials, but at least in the book it says 365 torturers were executed.
Correct.
And you ask him, well, what do you think of this? You're against the death penalty. Plus, if we believe you, these people were really controlled by the puppeteers, ITT, other big corporations. Shouldn't we have gone after the big guys, and was it right to execute these guys? And what's his answer?
Well, he really doesn't give an answer. He sort of says, well, I mean, you've got to, in the context, it's a difficult question and so on. I press him on the issue, and I said, look, if Fidel hadn't, there would have been incredible bloodbath. And this is a way of getting the Cuban people a catharsis so that they can avoid wanting vengeance, right, kind of thing. But he still hesitates. He still is in limbo there.
That's why you pushed him in here. Yeah. But to the ITT guy, as for him, Sartre says, I would have rather condemned the ITT president 20 to 20 years of cleaning latrines with a toothbrush. So that's his idea.
Well, the Nicaraguans later did that, and which was a superior position.
Well, superior or not. No. That's, I think, what Tito's bringing out here. What Tito is bringing out here and what he gets Sartre to agree is I agree that under an ideal situation, the torturers could have been rehabilitated. But I also agree with Fidel that at that moment, a bloodbath had to be avoided. And these torturers were scum, after all. So if executing them for their proven crimes is responsible, will avoid a bloodbath, then ethically their execution was justified. And look at Nicaragua. Nicaragua did not do that. And what you ultimately had is 8 years of a bloody war in which the Contras, with those same leaders who were not executed, went to the other side. So Nicaragua looked good by not doing it, and I, as a humanist, agree with it and don't like against the death penalty. But look at the cost Nicaragua paid by not doing that.
I totally agree.
And
with
there's a part, there's a part in there where Sartre actually says the trouble with all the revolutions is they give up too soon.
Oh, it's great in here, right? I thought that was wonderful. In fact, here he says that. He says, at the time the media concluded, this is about Fidel, that because the torturers were executed, 365 of them, it showed that Castro was not just a bourgeois reformer, as time in the United States hoped, but a genuine revolutionary, and so decided to condemn him. And it goes, there's other sections of the book that address that same issue.
I'm interested in the relationships that Sartre had with people like Fidel. I know he knew Camus for a period of time. Did anyone stand out during your conversations of anyone who influenced him particularly?
He did go to all sorts of places, right? And because he was Sartre, he got to see the leaders of China and Russia, whatever. Right? The only encounter where he was influenced somewhat, if not at least he was pleased with the contact, was Che Guevara. Right? With Fidel, he said, you know, sort of there's a part where he admires Fidel because Fidel does this, and then there's another part where he doesn't understand why Fidel does that, and so on, et cetera. He chastises Fidel for arresting people, charging them, well, specifically one, with counter-revolutionary attitude, right? And we have a long discussion of that because the attitude is about Padilla, this poet, who smokes marijuana, doesn't give a damn, that there's a law against it. And he asked me about it, and I said, well, look, I smoke marijuana. I've always smoked marijuana, but I don't do it in Cuba. He says, why not? And I said, the law is wrong. I think everybody should be able to smoke marijuana, but this is a young socialist country trying to survive in a world dominated by America. It passes this law. So in support of the regime, I will not smoke here, right? But I object to you, I said to him, picking on Padilla as your fencing weapon, because Padilla actually uses his status as a well-known poet to say, I'm an exception. And there are no such things as exceptions, right? The law is wrong, but if you're going to apply it, you apply it to everybody.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. We'll be right back.
we're talking with John Jurassic, who just wrote Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates, just came out. Wonderful book. Tito, your nickname, John Jurassic, Tito. Sartre famously said that Che Guevara was the most complete human being of the 20th century. Did you talk to him about Che? Because you knew Che also.
Yes. He was a little awed by Che's. The only person that I felt he was awed by, right? Especially statements like, if we can't establish a socialist man in Cuba, then the revolution isn't worth it, that kind of thing. Sartre felt that Che didn't have the understanding of the process. It takes a long time to get to establish socialist man, and that you have to first establish a socialist society in which you're going to push a particular morality which leads to socialist man. But at the same time, he had this incredible respect and admiration for the idealism of Che, that he's willing to always go and fight wherever, you know, wherever there's a revolution afoot, he's to join the revolutionaries, right, kind of thing. So it's kind of mixed, but it's the only one that he really sort of admired, even if he had criticisms for, but admired enough to want to know everything that there is to know about him. And he really asked me all sorts of questions about Che. He said, you saw him with his wife. What did you do with her when he was in the countryside? What did you do with her? And he kept asking me questions, which I didn't put in there because I'm not being the one that's interviewed, right? I mean, it's in the book, right? I'm interviewing Sartre. So, but he asked me, for example, at one point, do you ever meet Lin Piao? And I said, no.
Who's Lin Piao?
Lin Piao was the second in command under Mao. And we both agreed on the criticism that we had about the Maoist movement. We never, both of us thought that Lin Piao, who was officially designated as Mao's successor, but was extremely anti-Russian communist, would never have jumped in a plane and tried to escape to Russia. So that we both agreed that he obviously had been killed by those who wanted to crush the Cultural Revolution, right, kind of thing. But the conversation immediately, true, I didn't know Lin Piao, but turned to his philosophy. The same with, even with Che, whom I have met various times, it turned to Che's actions, not what he felt, right, kind of thing, except for one thing about this great thing where the great passage that he quotes about, that he puts in Listen, Yankee. Now, Listen, Yankee was C. Wright Mills.
Yes.
Hurricane in French, ouragan à Cuba. I don't know how it was translated in English.
Hurricane in Cuba is what it was that mean, the, literally, right?
Yeah, but was that the way it was?
Who knows?
Anyway, there's this passage there where he describes, he asks Fidel, how did you end up here? I mean, you had a good life. You did this, you did that. You're basically rich. You owned, if you wanted to inherit it, you owned a sugar plantation. And Fidel answers, because I've always been romantic. And Fidel's romantic? What kind of a revolutionary are you as a romantic? And he says, well, you know, is there justice in the world? No, I guess no, there isn't justice in the world. Well, I believe in justice. So I believe in something that doesn't exist. So obviously I'm a romantic.
His favorite book is Don Quixote, Fidel's favorite book.
Right.
You know, a couple of points that you've been talking about I want to go back to. And one is, of course, about what's necessary to make a revolution. And there's a nice discussion in here with you and Sartre about that. You say, perhaps above all, pride, faith, conviction, hatred of the enemy. Sartre then says that's very important, hatred. Without it, one often stops too soon. It happened in the French Revolution. I think it happens in every revolution, when those who do not hate the enemy suddenly say enough already and stop short of accomplishing the complete restructuring of society. So that's what you're speaking of in terms of when Fidel went as far as he did.
Right.
And then you go on to say what Che said, but love of those for whom one revolts too.
Right.
And then you quote Che does.
Yeah.
And so
it goes together. Che always said, yes, agreed to that. You got to hate your enemy, but you also have to love the human being as such, right, kind of thing.
I want to go back to the, again, terror. It's the counter-terror against established terror is the way Sartre puts it. And so you ask the question about Israel. You're talking about supporting the revolutionary actions of the Palestinians. This is in the early 70s. And so Sartre says, and so do I, so does the Israeli left. When Israel subjugates the Palestinians, takes away their land, stops them from being able to live free, but they support the armed struggle. They consider the suicide bombers freedom fighters. And Sartre, in this amazing line, says, I have always supported counter-terror against established terror.
Right.
And what I'm interested in, when the way Michael opened this talk, was that Sartre was one of our heroes during the 60s and 70s. And yet at the same time in the book, those kind of statements are in there, saying basically I believe in struggling against oppression and terror. But when you went to become a member or work with the Russell Tribunal on Vietnam, you went to Vietnam as part of the Russell Tribunal, you try and get Sartre to join, either become the nominal head of it or whatever. And the book discusses that Sartre was very reluctant to actually get out of his apartment or wherever he lived in Paris and either become head of the tribunal or work with the tribunal or certainly go to Vietnam. And it made me wonder whether he really, he spoke a lot about taking revolutionary stance and acting, but it always seemed like you had to push him to actually take action, at least certainly in that case. So just talk about that a little bit, because it seems almost in contradiction to some of what we've been speaking of.
That's true. I mean, it goes back even to his stand on the Spanish Civil War.
You know, right. He objected to your father going to Spain.
Right. He objects to my father going to Spain because he's an artist. Artists don't do those kind of things. And during the worst year, 37, of the Spanish Civil War, he goes off to Italy with Simone de Beauvoir, and he writes about the mortadella and things like that.
Who does he write about?
Doesn't even write about Mussolini. He writes about the food that he eats when he's in the...
This is Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, right, in Italy during the year of the Spanish Civil War.
Right.
34, what year or something?
37.
37.
Right. I said, well, did you support the Spanish? Of course we support. Well, how did you... when we were in Paris and there was a march, we would go on the march. And I said, did you march with the Popular Front in 1936? And he said, well, no, we didn't actually march. I said, did you vote for the Popular Front? I don't remember, he says. It turns out he didn't, right?
What was the Popular Front?
The Popular Front was in 1936. The reactionaries were in power. Up to that, there was an election coming up, and there was the communists had presented their slate, and the socialists had presented their. And the socialists were headed by a really, really absolutely firm socialist. And the communists began to waver where they support what kind of people. So they had two different marches. And by a fluke, the two marches met at Bastille. Bastille is where the jail used to be, the fortress, which is torn down, but it's now a nice big plaza.
Right. Bastille Day, July 14th, is the anniversary of the French Revolution.
That's right. So they meet there, and the socialist leader, Léon Blum, gets up on the stand to make a speech. The communists decide that they better not try to make a speech at the same time as Léon Blum, so they wait, right? And Léon Blum makes a speech addressing the communists and says, what are you guys doing over there? Come over here, right? And rank-and-file communists go over. And Valdecrochet and a few other communists try to hesitate and don't hold back. Doesn't work. All the communists go over and join the socialists, and that became the Popular Front. So the left, the Republicans, the socialists, the communists, all voted together, and they won the election, putting in a Popular Front, and chose Léon Blum as president. Right? It was an incredibly important event, you know. And Sartre takes the attitude, well, you know, we approved, we applauded, but didn't participate in any way, right? And it turns out didn't even vote in 36 in favor of anybody, didn't vote, because he went off to someplace else on a trip. And in 37, when there began to be real pressure against the Popular Front because it was helping the Republicans, there were huge demonstrations against
the Republicans being the opposition to Franco in Spain.
Right. There were huge demonstrations in Paris. That's when Sartre goes off, Simone de Beauvoir goes off to Italy and don't participate. And, you know, historically what happened is Léon Blum gave in. and resigned. He couldn't, and so on. And the new government, the new Popular Front government, agreed with the international pressure, United States.
So how do you explain this? I know I read Sartre's piece in the Commission on Vietnam, in the Russell Tribunal. And it's, you know, completely moving, brilliant, very important. But you had to actually fly to Paris on Christmas Day, meet with him, and say, I'm going to Vietnam. And he said, what for, essentially? Right. I mean, and why should I do this? And after like a two or three hour discussion, you apparently convince him. But what was this about? Why was it so hard to get him to move on these
issues?
Because
he basically took the position, it doesn't do any good. It's not going to do any good. Everybody will call it an ersatz. He actually uses the word ersatz, which means phony, tribunal, etc. For hours, I try to convince him. And then when I finished, he says, okay, you've done your job as a member of the committee. Now tell me as a friend, why are you going to Vietnam? Why are you willing to risk destroying your family, your marriage, and your
67.
66, I went.
66, okay.
Christmas 66. And I said, because it pleases the Vietnamese, and they're the victim. You know, they're the people who are being attacked, and we have to show our support. And he agrees to that. He said, I agree with him. I say, it's not going to do any good. The chances are it won't even be reported in New York Times or anywhere in the United States. But it pleases the Vietnamese, who are the victims, that people like Sartre and Russell and so on are on their side. And that's why I'm going in. So at that point, he says, okay, count me in.
And as it turned out, it did a lot of good.
Right.
It gave way to the Winter Soldier hearings in Detroit with the American GIs testifying about war crimes in Vietnam. And it was echoed by the Iraqi war veterans.
Right.
I mean, it did a lot of good. Still doing good. Yeah. We're speaking with John Jurassic. Talking with Sartre is his most recent book, Conversations and Debates, a fantastic book. The reason that Sartre so connected with young people in the 60s and why this book resonates now is that he preached action. Young people saw him as somebody that took sides and did stuff. What do you think Sartre would say now about President Obama and the looks like escalation of the war in Afghanistan, say another 40,000 troops over there? What would his position be on that? What would he say to American young people today?
He would tell them to go out in the street again. But it's very important about to understand Sartre's attitude. You know, all the 68 movement in France, the students took over all the Vera's building. They included the Athenaeum. The Athenaeum is where they all meet, all the great writers come and so on, philosophers, and make their big presentation to the world, so to speak. They seized it, and various people that supported, like Aragon, the communist poet, and so on, went there. They got booed by the students, and they couldn't understand, you know. Aragon called them a bunch of smugs and walked out, right? Sartre went, and Sartre also got booed. But he stayed through the booing. He just sat there, and finally somebody yelled, "Why are you here, Papa?" and he answered, "To learn." And suddenly the whole atmosphere changed, right? And he became one of them. Right? And that's the crucial part about Sartre, that Sartre always thought that the young would present, ultimately would present the right kind of answer, that the old were stuck in their ways and their histories and their background, whereas the young were out to learn at the same time as they did, and they learned from doing. And that's what he liked about them. And so today he would do the same thing. He would look around for those who have any kind of criticism against Obama and the administration. He might say, well, if you have that, why aren't you out in the streets protesting? Right? He certainly would say that there's not enough demonstrations and so on. But he would point to where there are demonstrations. Then he would tell, if he came to my school, for example, in my class, he would say, why aren't you doing what they're doing in Detroit or wherever, right, kind of thing. And he would ask those kind of questions. And by asking the questions, a little bit like Socrates, forced the students to reveal that they are on the side, but they understand that being on the side isn't enough unless you do something.
I want to back up for a second and talk for a moment about Marxism and existentialism. You spoke briefly about when you first went back after not seeing the Sartre family for 20 years or whatever, that you said to Sartre, you can't reconcile existentialism and Marxism. Can you just very briefly explain for some of us who aren't so familiar with Marxism, yes, but with existentialism and how those two couldn't be reconciled?
Well, basically, existentialism begins with the I. And from the I, eventually, does get to the same position as Marxism.
And position
class,
being?
The class struggle and so on. But it really means that you start with trying to find meaning in your life. And you little by little realize that there is no meaning in your life, right? And the meaning of whatever meaning there is in the commune, right, kind of thing. The example that I gave is, which I think characterizes his notion of the I to the we, but also the idea of permanent revolution, is when they're waiting for a bus on Third Avenue when all the traffic and so on at 5 o'clock and when everybody's coming out and this huge line of people waiting to get on the bus. And the first bus comes and it's so packed that the driver doesn't open the door in the front. Second bus comes, the same thing. And the third bus that comes says, not in service, and it's empty. And because of the traffic, it's stuck right smack in front of where the people are all waiting for the bus. They look at it, and they stare at it, and suddenly one guy pushes his hand through the rubber thing that holds the door, forces the door open, and the driver says, I'm off duty, I'm off duty. Where are you going? So I'm going to the garage. Where's the garage? Well, 167. You drop me off on the way, and everybody else follows suit, and they all get on. And eventually what happens is that they all relate to each other. They say, where are you going? Where is it on, et cetera? She's on Fifth Avenue. You're going up Third. Hey, listen, this lady can't walk very well. Make a little detour, right? We'll all sign that we forced you. And they all sign a letter and so on. After a while, they begin to talk to each other, find out what their problems, how many kids they have, what they do, why they work in this plant, why they hate the kind of job that they have. And it becomes what he calls a group infusion. Unfortunately, they all get off the bus and go back to their work, etc., and they suddenly become serialized again. So that's the difference that he makes. A group infusion is a revolutionary group. If it could only be maintained, right, you would have the beginning of a revolution. But what happens in that group infusion is they recognize the importance of their fellow human beings, right, and realize that there's a we. The I leads to a we, right? The Marxists say, look, this is very nice, but they point out it does fail, right? After a while, the group infusion becomes serialized again. So what do we do? How do we keep going? What you have to do, the Marxists say, in effect, is to create the theory and put the theory through an actual party that would organize those people so that they wouldn't feel serialized when they got off the bus, right? And Sartre's opposed to that, right? Because he says that's democratic centralism. He's always been opposed to democratic centralism. Why? Because it leads to what happened in Russia and so on. But he disagreed because when we talk about China, he said, you know, yes, okay, it led to a failure, but nobody, even the children that weren't born yet, are never going to forget the Cultural Revolution. It's already become part of the Chinese ethos, and it'll spring up again. What, 50 years from now? What's 50 years in history?
Going back to some of the other subjects, you're quoted about Sartre favoring or at least supporting or thinking it was fine to do counter-terror against terror. And Sartre must have been in Paris during the Algerian War, as we've talked about. And after the Algerians were put through torture, as is well known, they began to bring the war home to France. And at least one of those incidents, as I recall, and it's all very vague, was bombing a nightclub or a disco in Paris. The Algerians were accused of doing that, killing a number of French people. And then that's sort of, you know, it's in some way fighting terror in Algeria with counter-terror in France. Would Sartre's beliefs have gone that far in thinking about that?
He supported all the acts by the Algerian revolutionaries. You got to remember, there were two groups, right? There was FLN, there's MNA. The MNA wanted to keep Algeria French, but to be in a sort of independent and have their own parliament and so on, like autonomy, like that kind of thing. And it ended up that the MNA and the FLN were at war with each other. So there was a lot of difficulties there for a while, and until the real left which included at that point Sartre and dissident Communist Party, Vigier and people like that, who later created the center of communist activity, right, rather than the Communist Party. They came out in favor of FLN, and the Temps Modernes, of course, led that. What that meant in practice, they supported the FLN activity to the point where they would distribute the newspapers openly that sided with it. And this is where that famous statement with de Gaulle appears, right? Because the system for publication in France is that there has to be a responsible editor. The responsible editor is the one that you arrest the first time that when you want to close down a newspaper. So everybody, all the anti-government newspapers, asked Sartre to be the responsible editor. He was responsible editor for the Trotskyist paper, too, for the VLR, for others, and, of course, for La Cause du Peuple, the People's Cause, which was his group, right? The Mao. I call them moralistic Maoists because they're not quite Maoist, and they do very moral actions, like seizing food and distributing it to poor people and so on, right, kind of thing. Anyway, so Sartre, the de Gaulle government, Marcelin was the prime minister, ordered the newspaper closed. And Sartre immediately said, in order to close it, you have to charge the responsible editor. And so he went personally and started hawking the newspaper in front of the big police station, right in front. And, of course, he didn't get arrested. So when next time that de Gaulle had a press conference, somebody said, you know, look, this is what Sartre does, and you didn't even arrest him. How come you didn't arrest him? And de Gaulle yells, you know, France does not arrest its Voltaires. And, of course, he was wrong, because Voltaire was arrested twice, right? But
we're gonna close as we come to an end of a completely fascinating interview again with John Gerassi. The book is Talking with Sartre. It's John Gerassi, or Tito as we call him. It's Conversations with Jean-Paul Sartre, 1970 to 73. One of the things that struck me as we've had this conversation, of course, is the struggle for freedom, the struggle for revolution. And one of the quotes that I loved is, Sartre wrote a novel about your father in the Spanish Civil War and otherwise. And your father's a major character in that novel. And your father is the quote that's attributed to your father in the book. It's just wonderful, and if you have any comment on it, it's really about the Spanish Civil War at that point, but you could substitute other words for fascism or whatever. The quote is, Sartre has your father say, quote, "You don't fight fascism because you're going to win. You fight fascism because it is fascist." And I just think that's just a great—
And it really happened that way. I mean, my father had come to France to buy some weapons and so on. Finagle with Malraux, who was very good at that point, how to filter him into Spain. And so he had arrived in Toulouse. And as soon as Sartre learned that he was in Toulouse, he went. He never displaces himself for anybody. But there
they loved your father.
Yeah, he went straight to Toulouse. And they have this conversation. Sartre says, in real life, said, so how's it going there? And my father says, we're going to lose. And Sartre is stunned. He said, you're going back? No, of course I'm going back. Why are you going back if you're going to lose? Right? And that's when he says, you don't fight fascism because you're going to win. You fight fascism because they're fascists.
Right? So this quote in the novel is actually what your father
absolutely
said. Absolutely. It's just absolutely beautiful. I mean, it really makes, when we go through all these struggles in our lives, as you have more than any of us probably, it really tells us a lot. So
the last two sentences in the book, Sartre is not just the century's greatest moralist, he is also its greatest prophet. John Gerassi, author of Talking with Sartre, Conversations and Debates, thank you very much for being on Law
My
and
pleasure.
Disorder.
Yeah, completely wonderful.
My pleasure.
It's fabulous. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.